What does it take to be a spy writer? Let's ask AI. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Season 5. Episode 11 of the Real Spies, Real Lives podcast. This is where we talk about writing, spies, and writing about spies. I'm your host, espionage author P.A. Duncan. You can't be on social media right now and not see an ad for something related to AI, artificial intelligence. The ones that particularly vex me are the ones where people declare they've sold millions of copies of their books where they didn't even have to write a single word. In other words, AI wrote it for them, they published it, and now they're selling millions of copies. And if you believe that, I have a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you. I early on promised my readers I would never, never use AI to write one of my novels. Indeed, I now place a 100% human-written graphic on the copyright page of my books. Now, I can write some decent fiction. It's not just me who says that. Other people have told me that. Rest assured. But what I'm not good at is writing ad copy or promotional copy for my books. I've never been able to conquer that, and not for lack of trying. I just don't have that sales spark. You can ask the store where I worked as a teenager, and they immediately took me out of retail and put me on the cash register. What I have discovered is artificial intelligence is good at writing ad copy when you give it very specific instructions. For the last couple of months, then, when I schedule my social media promotional posts or ads, I've used artificial intelligence to create the ad copy. Turns out, AI is a better hustler than I am, because I have noticed increased engagements with my posts since I started using it for that. I know several other writers who would never dream of using AI to write a book who are using AI for ads and social media posts. I still feel a little sleazy using it even for that, which is why I guess right now I'm confessing it. Now, I'm no Luddite. I was an original Trekker, though, and in the 1960s episode of Star Trek The Original Series, The Ultimate Computer, we learned the possible dangers of AI gone rogue years before the Terminator movies. In that episode, a computer genius designs an artificial intelligence that could take the place of a starship crew and captain. And the Enterprise, with only a skeleton crew, is assigned to test it. Long story short, the creator of the AI has used his own neural engrams in the program, and he's having a mental health crisis. So the AI goes mad and starts picking off non-hostile ships. Even Spock, the ultimate science officer, has reservations about the artificial intelligence called M5, saying, "Computers make excellent and efficient servants, but I have no wish to serve under them." I've kept that in mind ever since I heard that line. Exactly how I feel about it. So, I decided to have a spot of fun with artificial intelligence this week. And I asked one version of it What does it take to become an espionage writer? After a few seconds, it spat out a fleshed-out outline entitled Mastering the Art of Writing Spy Fiction, a Comprehensive Guide for Aspiring Writers. Wow. Never let it be said AI doesn't make an effort. I thought it might be amusing to review what the AI said about how to become a spy writer and compare that to, well, me. Here we go. The first section of the outline is titled Introduction to the Intriguing World of Spy Fiction. Quote, Welcome to the thrilling world of spy fiction, where espionage, intrigue, and suspense converge to create captivating narratives that keep readers on the edge of their seats. Spy fiction has long been a beloved genre for those who enjoy delving into the secretive and dangerous world of spies and covert operations. End quote. I can't really find anything to quibble about in that definition, even if it's a bit flowery and repetitive. It matches what I've found in researching espionage and covert operations and writing, so score one for me. The next quote, I think, shows the shortcomings of artificial intelligence. That is, it repeats itself. For example, quote, Spy fiction encompasses a wide range of works, including espionage novels, spy thriller books, and stories that explore the intricate web of intelligence agencies and undercover agents, end quote. I'm not certain there's a difference between espionage novels, spy thriller books, and stories that explore, etc., etc. And next, we get a sample of how good AI is at ad copy. Quote, Authors in this genre skillfully weave together elements of mystery, action, and political intrigue to craft compelling narratives that transport readers into a world of clandestine missions and high-stakes espionage. End quote. Again, a rather common definition that I can't find much to quibble with, though it's now a compelling narrative as opposed to the earlier captivating narrative. And yes, I do all that weaving of elements into my stories, so score two for me. Also, artificial intelligence needs an editor. It tends to say something, say the same thing a different way in the next sentence, and yet another way in another sentence. The editor in me would spasm if I were to ever read an artificial intelligence-generated novel, I fear. In the next section of the outline, Understanding the Key Elements of a Gripping Spy Fiction Plot, the artificial intelligence result is pretty basic. Quote, A delicate balance of key elements that keep readers on the edge of their seats. End quote. Repetition again. This section then goes on to explain that spy writers must, quote, incorporate complex espionage schemes, create suspense, and incorporate secrets to build tension and create layers of complexity. End quote. Check, check, and check for me. Doing all this, according to AI, keeps readers guessing, and still on the edge of their seats, I imagine, keeps readers hooked, and keeps readers engaged. Of course, it's also important to move the narrative forward, skillfully reveal secrets, and create shocking twists and turns that leave readers eager for more. Again, not very original or detailed, and no how-to, just a recitation of so-called required elements, which it claims will keep the readers on tenterhooks until the very last page. I honestly think M5 back in 1968 could have done better. maybe even Hal from the movie 2001. The artificial intelligence's outline goes on to stress the importance of, guess what, crafting compelling characters to engage readers. So you need, according to it, a complex protagonist who has depth. Duh. And a villain who is memorable. Again, duh. Now, at this point, the artificial intelligence said the first logical thing I could wholeheartedly agree with. Quote, "In recent years, there has been a growing demand for strong female spies in literature who are intelligent, resourceful, and capable of holding her own." End quote. Hells yeah, that's exactly what I write. Since artificial intelligence is known to scrape content from the internet, who knows? Maybe this particular AI program scanned one of my blog posts or podcasts about strong female characters. Again, the artificial intelligence's outline regurgitates common aspects of writing, not simply spy fiction, but any kind of fiction. Research for realism, maintain pace and tension by using action-packed scenes and varying levels of tension, while you're creating tension, apparently. Crafting unforgettable twists and unexpected endings. That latter part is a bit difficult in historical fiction, though. Again, another thing this artificial intelligence outline offered that I wholeheartedly agree with is to not shock readers for shock's sake. That is, gratuitous sex and violence. So do all of the above, AI says, and you'll, quote, create stories that linger in the mind of your audience long after they've turned the final page. Yep, AI, that's what every writer hopes for. AI's final bit of advice for aspiring spy writers is to read the works of successful ones like John le Carré and Ian Fleming and Stella Remington, who, by the way, was the first woman to head Britain's MI5. By reading and analyzing classic and modern spy fiction, AI says you'll give your readers, quote, a rich tapestry of stories that explore themes of loyalty, betrayal, patriotism, and sacrifice, end quote. I can't quibble with that either. So the AI concludes the outline by saying that yours will be a unique voice in the genre, that you'll bring your personal touch to the genre. Well, that's called paradigm of self, by the way. And therefore, set your work apart from others in the genre. Perhaps the AI does give itself a bit of a dig in the concluding sentence of the outline, quote, in a world where AI tools are becoming increasingly prevalent in content creation, standing out as an espionage writer means embracing what makes you different. So go ahead, write boldly, write authentically, and bring your own unique voice to the thrilling world of espionage literature, end quote. I couldn't have said it better. Nah, I could have. And now it's commercial time. Starting today, March 14th, 2024. Actually, it's already started because it started at midnight Pacific time. And going through March 18th, 2024, my debut mystery novel, Supreme Madness of the Carnival Season, will be free. Yes, free to download. March 18th is Supreme Madness's first book birthday. So my present to you is a free book for 5 days. Or as ChatGPT might put it, embark on an exhilarating journey into the enigmatic world of Supreme Madness of the Carnival Season with this free download of the riveting mystery novel. This captivating tale weaves together intricate plot lines and compelling characters, inviting readers to unravel the secrets lurking beneath the surface. I know I sound like William Shatner, don't I? I'll go with that. With each page turn, suspense mounts, drawing readers deeper into a labyrinth of twists and turns where nothing is as it seems. Don't miss this opportunity to immerse yourself in a thrilling adventure, where the line between illusion and reality blurs, and every clue holds the key to uncovering the truth. Download your copy now, and prepare to be enthralled by the supreme madness of the carnival season. Yes, AI does have a unique voice itself, as voiced by me. I had a little fun with it, okay? I'll put the link to the free download in the description of this episode. And commercial over. Today's reading from Supreme Madness of the Carnival Season, and I won't be as hokey about it as I was earlier, is from about two-thirds of the way into the book. We're in the 1944 time frame, and in the aftermath of characters Charles and Cecilia Lee learning that their older son, Joe Lee, was killed on D-Day. Supreme Madness of the Carnival Season, Part 6, Little Slices of Death, Chapter 28, July 1944. Charles Lee hacked his way through a coughing fit. First thing in the morning and late evening were the worst. He'd start coughing and couldn't stop, would lose his breath, and feel as if he'd had it knocked out of him. Nothing worked to ease it. Not the whorehound syrup Cecilia made with some whiskey, not the whiskey itself. The coughing was hard and wet, and his ribs ached from it. He couldn't walk across the room without coughing, couldn't sleep through the night from coughing. Worse yet, he couldn't get a hard on. He'd never worked the mines like his grandfather had for 30 years, his father for 10, but he'd smoked and chewed tobacco since he was 8. His mother had nagged and nagged about it, and maybe he was paying the price now. Cecilia, his wife, wanted him to go to Charlottesville to have his lungs checked, but hell, he was nearing 60. What could the quacks in Charlottesville tell him that the quacks here couldn't? The coughing stilled long enough for him to relax in his comfortable chair. He listened to his breath rattle in his chest. His handkerchief was wet with phlegm, but he folded it and put it away in his pants pocket. He started to yell for Cecilia to get him a clean one, but she was up in her room, pacing. He could hear the boards above his head creaking as she walked. Damn. The woman had walked miles in the last couple of days. Women always took losing their firstborn hard. They still had Jesse, and the army wouldn't be coming after him now because his brother was dead. Even if the army got desperate enough to want Jesse, this time Charles would pay off a doctor to have him declared 4F. It wasn't that he didn't hate losing Joe. He did. He and the boy had been more like friends, and whoring with Joe reminded Charles of his younger days, more and more distant now in his memory. But Joe wasn't Charles's firstborn. His oldest boy was close to 40 now, but of course, Charles couldn't bring him here to replace Joe. Cecilia was hard-headed about not having any of his bastards around. Charles had a farm down near Bedford and had put that boy in charge of it, even though he was planning on giving that farm to Joe when he turned 21. Now he supposed it would go to Jesse, but that boy didn't have the head for farming. Cecilia could stay on here in this house until she passed, but she was a lot younger. She'd be here a long time, unless she starved herself to death over Joe. Charles didn't much like thinking on his own death, and in truth, he hadn't given it much thought until this winter. Once he'd gotten out of his 30s without a jealous husband or an outraged father shooting him, he'd decided to live his life and never look back. He'd always gotten a winter cold. Everyone did. This one had hit him harder than any other and had lingered too long for his comfort and made him think about dying. He reached for the bell to call Cecilia's girl to get him a clean handkerchief and heard a knock on the front door. He couldn't make out the murmuring in the hallway. Then a soft tap came on the door of his study, as Cecilia called it. The door opened and the black girl peeked around it, shy and skittish. "What is it, girl?" Charles asked, his words coming out slowly so he wouldn't make himself cough. "Mr. Randolph Matheson is here, Mr. Charles. He's asking to talk with you," she said. A tickle teased the back of Charles' throat. "What about?" "He didn't say, Mr. Charles. I know you don't like me to ask." "Get in here and move the whiskey and two glasses to the table here. Bring another chair next to the fire across from me." "Yes, sir." She scurried to obey, placing an almost full bottle of Virginia Gentleman and two clean glasses on the small table next to his chair. She scooted another chair near the fireplace. "Is Mrs. Lee dressed?" Charles asked.
"No, sir."
"She eat today?"
"I took a tray up this morning, Mr. Charles, but when I come back to get it, she ain't touched a thing."
"Fix her a ham sandwich and a glass of iced tea. Take it to her and tell her I said to eat it."
"Yes, Mr. Charles."
"Send Mr. Matheson in first."
"Yes, sir,"
she replied and left, closing the door.
Randolph Matheson entered a few seconds later. Matheson was a tall, rangy man with soft hands. He had dressed in a suit as if he'd come from that Papist church of his.
"Come in, Ran," Charles said. "Pardon me if I don't get up. I can't shake this damn cold I've had since winter."
"Sorry to hear you're still feeling bad with that, Charles."
Matheson pronounced it Charles.
"Have a seat," Charles said, nodding to the other chair.
Matheson seemed not to hear him, his gaze instead straying to the window and getting lost there. Matheson was from way up north somewhere, but considered himself a gentleman farmer. He'd bought the old Stewart place next to Charles's farm. Most folks, Charles included, had laughed behind Matheson's back at his big city way of talking about the city boy trying to farm. They thought he'd last a year, if that. But instead, Matheson had been a quick study. He took the advice offered him and had become a decent farmer himself. His wife, though, had never taken to country life and let the cancer eat her up.
"My hands are shaking too much, Rand, so pour some whiskey," Charles said.
Matheson roused himself from some reverie and sat next to Charles. He splashed three fingers of bourbon in each glass and picked one up. Charles did the same. They sipped in silence, and Charles continued to study the other man. Troubled men were often vulnerable.
What is it I can do for you, Rand?"
What? Oh, well, Charles, I was sorry to hear about your boy."
"Thanks, Ran," he replied, noticing Matheson's upper lip and his brow dotted with beads of sweat. "His mother took it hard, but the women don't understand about serving your country."
"Were you in the Great War?" Matheson asked.
"Yeah, I dug my share of trenches. I don't think about it."
"You?"
"I was in the Lafayette Espadrille, then the U.S. Air Corps, after we got into the war."
"Oh, I didn't know that."
Charles swallowed some bourbon, relieved it seemed to alleviate the tickle at the back of his throat.
I don't think about it much either," Matheson said.
"Were you an ace?"
"One short, but I got that Distinguished Flying Cross retroactively, after they established it. Look, Charles, I've got something pretty serious to discuss with you, and it's a hard thing for me to talk about, what with your boy gone and all. I don't want you to think I'm speaking ill of the dead."
"Well, Rand, have more bourbon and tell me what you got on your mind."
Matheson refilled his glass, four fingers this time, and said, "Your boy, Joe, he was stopping by the farm a lot before he left for boot camp, talking to my daughter, Olivia. And now she's in the family way." "Sounds like he did a bit more than talking," Charles said, smiling behind his glass of whiskey. His boy had outdone him. Charles's firstborn hadn't come till he was 20. Are you sure it's my boy's?" Matheson sat upright in the chair. "What are you saying? Are you saying my daughter's a easy?" "Easy, Ran. I have to ask for his mother's sake." What follows after this portion of the scene is one of the most intricate and complex scenes in the whole novel, a scene I probably worked on longer than any other in the novel, because it had to be just right. Now, don't forget that this novel, Supreme Madness of the Carnival Season, is free for the next 5 days. See the link in the description of this episode to download it. And those of us who can claim an Irish heritage, as well as those who can't but celebrate anyway, have a special day coming up. On March 17th, it's St. Patty's Day. In Ireland, it was originally a holy day, but the pedantic Bishop Patrick fell out of favor when the Irish examined how much of their rich heritage and culture he expunged because he considered it too pagan. And he wasn't even Irish. He was a Roman. The Irish would never adulterate beer with green dye, by the way, but drink it up if you like. But don't get so armishke, drunk, that you can't keep an eye out for spies and AIs. The proceeding has been a production of Unexpected Paths Media, copyright 2024, all rights reserved. Join us next week for a new episode of the Real Spies, Real Lives podcast. And, as always, Slava Ukraini!